high-speed rail hits a wall. From Fox News Radio, I'm Dana Perino.
And I'm Chris Steyerwalt.
And this is Perino and Steyerwalt. I'll tell you what.
Tell you what.
So you didn't like the intro line? Because, like, I was iffy on it. And Bonewall was like, well, you keep, you know, sort of being hard on me with these opening lines. And the thing is, I took a red-eye flight last
night. So you just... You just got to live with whatever you got.
And so I'm looking at it. I'm like, you know, that could be improved, but nah.
You're like me and Tor the diabetic cat at the buffet. It's just whatever's there, we're going to take
We're just going to go with that.
We're going to live with it. Yep.
Yeah,
and now I get to do what, and because Jason Bonewald is here in Washington, I get to have your experience, which is I can look through the glass wall at his judgment.
And he can roll his eyes at about me.
Totally. You can switch it up. For 1 week, we can switch it up.
So let's just talk about red-eye flights for a moment.
Yes, ma'am.
What is your preference? To take a red-eye to get back to work or to take another day off of work and fly all day to get back?
So it depends on what I'm doing. I can do a lot of my work remotely. And if I have TV hits that can be booked out of a studio – and sort of make the note work while I'm traveling, that's great. If that doesn't work, you know, I can go, as an old human, I can do one short sleep. I can do the one zombie day and then catch up for it the next day or after that. But if I've had a long amount of travel or it's been an arduous trip, the red eye, you're not going to like the work product. You're not going to like the result that you get when I arrive.
Also, why do they reserve the worst planes for the flights back overnight? I don't understand.
Last night,
it felt like we were in a plane. It felt like being in a car that has no suspension. You know what I mean? But, of course, the weather's terrible. I'm like, I didn't sleep at all, but, of course, I did.
Right.
I can make the most out of a seat because I'm small.
That is true.
I can turn on my side. I got this way to turn into a ball. And I have one of those neck pillow things, but I use it in a different way.
And like what?
I can wedge myself into a seat.
Yes.
And actually curl up like a ball in a fetal position and sleep.
Can you sleep inside the neck pillow? What are you trying to say?
I'm in a ball in the seat.
Right.
Using the neck pillow, but not like sitting up using the neck pillow, but like lying down using the neck pillow.
You are so small. That is really, because I told you about the last time I took a red eye, and I was coming back from Seattle ish.
Yeah.
And I woke up and realized that I had been snoring so loudly that everyone in the cabin must have hated me with the white hot passion of 10,000 suns. And I was just—I was so sorry.
I didn't know that.
Did anybody have red eye breath on your flight?
Oh, have I talked about this?
I've talked about it.
It's unbelievable. The worst. I actually had Peter and I went to the store right before we left. We didn't have much time from getting to the airport to the boarding of the plane, and so we have to buy more gum. He said, "Why? I have a toothbrush." And I said, yeah, but sometimes you sleep up until the time when they turn off the seatbelt sign and you can't get up to brush your teeth and you might not have bottled water because you don't want to use the tap water that's in the bathrooms, in the sinks, in the airport, in the airplane.
You don't?
No, you don't.
I didn't know that.
Oh, yeah. That was when I was deputy press secretary. That was like one of my first scandals I had to deal with.
Why?
Because there had been some study that showed that it is not safe to drink.
Huh.
Or really? I shouldn't say that. Look, airlines, don't sue Fox News for me saying this. This is going back, I think it was 2005.
Okay.
I remember as deputy press secretary, and I asked Trent Duffy, the other press secretary. I was like, do you think this is a big deal? Like, yeah, who would even think about brushing their teeth without water anyway? I'm like, well, apparently people do. And yeah, there was something like, you know, it's not like you would really want to brush your teeth with it.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Maybe
they've improved things since then. Again, it was 2005. Please don't sue Fox News.
I have never done that in my life.
Oh, yeah. We'll look it up. Bonewall, look it up for Chris, and we can show him that you don't want to drink that water.
Do you have the little Colgate instant toothbrushes?
I have had those. I don't love them.
I don't love them, but at least...
But it'll do.
It'll get you through.
But if you have... Trident gum.
Yeah, the scrapey kind.
Then you can actually kind of get by.
Yeah, you can get by.
So no, sure I'm enough, that's what happened because there was turbulence. You couldn't get up to brush your teeth. So I was like, here's two pieces of gum. I got two pieces of gum and we were good to go.
I am a Listerine breath strip. Those things are awesome.
Yeah, they're a little strong.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
I can take it.
Do they come in the orange flavor?
Oh, my gosh.
What? I like the orange flavor.
Ah, it tastes like burning. It tastes like, no. You want the...
Not original. Not the original.
I can go for the brown, which is just like pain. Which just tastes like pain. And it's like this is... It's much...
No, that tastes
much,
like my grandparents' house in Rollins, Wyoming.
Right.
They had that.
It tastes like Calvinism.
Yeah.
And you're like, this is not, it's not all fun and games here, people, but we've got to clean this out. So there's that. I can handle that one. I am a fresh mint. The orange Listerine is a war crime and should not be allowed. And it tastes like burning. And once you use it, it will mar your soul forever.
Well,
that's shocking.
I like it. Yeah. But then there were these two guys. They were pretty funny. They were coming back from some sort of work, and they had upgraded, so they had better seats. But the guy, you remember on the show Wings, how they had to do everything?
Right.
Because they had a little airport. So we were flying back from Palm Springs, and the guy was working late last night. He had to do the announcements but also open the door. So he like kept going back and forth. He's like, now we'll board group number one. And then he would go back. And like board group number one, and then he would have to walk back over and like, now we'll board group number two. And then he would walk back over and go, well, you know how there's all the layers of people that can get on board, the disabled, children under two, active military service.
Right.
These guys who had upgraded were so frustrated because they really wanted to get on the plane first because they wanted to make sure they had room for their bags up above. And this guy was just busting them. Every layer of possible person that could board before global elite or whatever it's called, you know, like it was hilarious.
Are you those running for president in 2020 may now board the plane.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. It was pretty funny. And then there was these three young women. Well, I shouldn't say young. I don't know, but they were probably younger than me. They're clearly in a band.
Get out of here.
And I think they were probably something probably like up and coming.
Yeah.
And I have no idea who they were, but I have a feeling I was sitting next to someone famous.
Nice.
And talented.
And they were sitting next to someone famous and talented. So then it all evens out.
Yeah. The guys who upgraded, their other friend came up to see them, and he goes, Dana? And I looked up and I said, yes, sir. He goes, oh, my gosh. And the other guys are like, who's that? What are you talking about? And he goes, W's press secretary. And they're like, what? They have no idea. Like, W didn't mean anything to them, nothing. It was pretty funny. And I was like, I'm going to sleep. Because I had just done a big event out in Palm Springs. It was a great event. But you know how I think I'm more of an introvert than I thought I was initially?
Right, right.
Wow, it took a lot out of me. I was depleted. I had no energy left.
Was it a good event, though?
Great event. Really great. Really great.
Oh, very good.
So that was fun. And people got to go with me. I saw friends out there. It's kind of a cool place, Palm Springs.
It is a very cool place. I'm excited. I'm going to a cool place this weekend. I'm going to Savannah, Georgia for the Savannah Book Festival.
It's the best.
And unfortunately, our friend Daniel Krauthammer is not able to attend this weekend. Yeah, he's not able to attend this weekend. So that means that I'm the headliner.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Do you need any friends to hang out with you there? Because
you've already hooked me up with one.
Yeah, but that's in Palm Springs.
Oh, that's in Palm Springs. I've been emailing all wrongly. I'll have to do.
You said you're going to Palm Springs.
I am eventually going to Palm Springs, like
in
March.
And I was in Palm Springs, and I'm like, yeah. Well, I thought that's what you were emailing about. March 9th?
Well, I'm glad I didn't send the email that I should learn to read. But okay, yes, I don't know how you put up with me.
I'm not really sure either. no, but the Shybergs in South Carolina,
Yeah.
Well, in Savannah, that could be good pals of yours.
I'm in. Saturday. I've got the big event Friday night, and then Saturday morning I'm doing.
Are you the main speaker Friday night?
Yep.
Holy cow, that's a big deal. I didn't even do that.
Do you know that I looked up today? I just found out that I could look up. Do you know that 25,000 copies of my book have been sold? That 25,000 human beings have done that?
I believe that.
I find that shocking. I find that amazing.
I think that's great.
I'm shocked.
I'm a little freaked out for you that you're the main speaker.
Why?
Because you're going to be great.
You've never seen my
venue.
Speech.
I bet your speech is so good.
My speech is good. It's like I talk about basically that we have to be worthy of our heritage and that we're not. And what do we do to be that way?
Oh, you're going to be great. So the person that was the main speaker of the year I went was mm-hmm. Eric Larson.
Yeah.
Who wrote all the, like, Devil mm-hmm. in the White City and a
great
couple
book.
Of others. Yeah.
The one that he wrote about the Lusitania is wonderful. Dead Wake.
Oh, that was the one that he was there to promote that year.
Dead Wake was such a good book.
Yep. Well, you're going to have fun. And by the way, did you know they have good food in Savannah?
I've heard something about that.
Yep. Not queso.
I will email your friends in Palm Springs and give me your contact information for your friends in Savannah.
Okay.
Get this all sorted.
Hey, just because I think it's a glorious decision, can we talk about how it took Gavin Newsom to finally kill the high-speed rail boondoggle in California? Amazing.
I am surprised because I thought that Newsom would be much more of a captive. Jerry Brown, California, Jerry Brown is very liberal and, his nickname, Governor Moonbeam and all that stuff. But he was relatively pragmatic and was not afraid to veto stuff that he thought was dangerous or extreme or whatever. But I thought Newsom would be much more of a captive. But he did spike that, and he did talk about it in his State of the State address or whatever the version
is. It wasn't
is.
Even like a Friday night announcement.
Nope. And he said Megan McArdle has a really good piece.
You could say that every time she writes something, she's got a really good piece.
But she has a very good explainer. So it's great that Americans travel and see the world, and young people should see the world, and travel is a great investment. But when young people go to Europe or now when they go to China and they see – or Japan and they see these amazing railroads. Wow. Look at these fantastic railroads. There is a belief that this is somehow not only that it's superior but that the same model can be made to work here. Now, we have major infrastructure problems in the United States. We have a lot to address as it relates to that and what we're going to do about it from here. But high-speed rail, there are portions of the United States, like the Acela, could be made better. Texas, for example, could do well because they have so many big cities.
Oh, they're working on one, actually. It actually could probably work. It's between Dallas and Austin. No.
Yeah.
Houston and Dallas, and then maybe Austin, too.
Yeah, some sort of a triangle to get people around Texas. That could be good. And also, by the way, San Francisco to L.A., I mean, I guess I could see it. I don't know why there's that much traffic between those two cities, but I guess I could see it. There are limited places in the country where it would work. And the idea that one day people will travel in the United States the way that they travel in Europe forgets geography. This is a huge country. It also forgets this. We have property rights in the United States. What does it take to do what they've done in China? And what does it take to do what they've done in Europe? Which is you have to have a government that can come in and say, I'm taking your stuff and we're using it for the better good. We have eminent domain here. Can you imagine the eminent domain that would be involved in the United States? Let's say you wanted to connect New York to Chicago with high-speed rail. There are a lot of people who would have some serious objections to losing their property, to losing their businesses, to losing their homes to this idea. We are not talking about farmland here. We're talking about busy places. And it's we have to think on to the next thing. We can't think about trying to be someplace else. We have to be American. We have to figure out, I don't know, teleportation. I don't know, but we have to figure out something better the next thing, not go to the last thing.
Well, I just like seeing that project, and because I've been reading the Wall Street Journal for 20 years.
Yep.
And they editorialize about it all the time. And it was just amazing. He's like, okay, yeah, we're just going to stop that. I like that. That was impressive. Also, I know people are making too much out of this resolution of the Green New Deal, but it's been kind of fun.
What do you mean making too much out of it?
Well, I think that it's gotten an exorbitant amount of coverage. And there's lots of other stuff going on. Do you not think so? Because it's a 14-page resolution that's going nowhere.
Well, it's a 14-page resolution that's going nowhere, but let me take the side.
Of course, of course you know how I feel about it. It's just I got a lot of coverage.
I don't know how you feel about it. You didn't see
me on Tucker Carlson talking about it?
Nope. I do know this. I know that it would be better to have a complete conversation about this subject. It would, and I think, frankly, it is helpful and useful for environmentalists to talk about what they really believe and what they really want. I think the hidden ball trick isn't good. And I think that – so we have a category of people in the United States who believe that we are 10 years away, 5 years away. We are close at hand to an ecological disaster that threatens our very species. There are a lot of people who disagree with that point of view, but if you really think it's true, it's sort of like the people who are like the deep state people, or as I call them, the derp state, where it's like all of the secret conspiracy and all of these things are happening. And as I say to those people, well, gee, if you think that's true, you better like move out to the Guyandot Valley of West Virginia and start growing turnips because it's on. Like it's time for the revolution, bro. And if you think that we are 5 or 10 years away from the submersion of the East Coast of the United States, that we are facing climate disaster that threatens our very species, then of course you would spend trillions of dollars. Of course you would do anything. And they actually believe that it's so. And I think it's useful and helpful for them to come out and say that it's so and that this is what they want to do so that we can have a more real conversation than that. And I do think that it is beyond churlish. I think Ed Markey, roller coaster foe, anti-roller coaster activist, Ed Markey. That's like every time you find out that what's his name, the coach of the Seahawks, used to coach USC. And then every time then somebody's like also a 9/11 truther. And you're like, oh, yeah, I forgot about that.
Oh,
never
yeah,
mind.
That guy.
So Ed Markey, senator from Massachusetts, comes out and says – how dare they bring this up for a vote in the Senate? This is just a point of discussion, and it hasn't had the process to move it forward.
Yeah,
then don't introduce it. Right. Duh. Like
also, he was the he really led the charge on that climate, the cap and trade, or not cap and trade. Oh, whatever it was, climate thing that they did in 2009, right when Obama was elected.
Cap and trade.
Was it cap and trade?
Cap and trade. Cost. In my thought, it cost Democrats at least as many seats as Obamacare.
Yes, I agree. So that's why I think, right.
And what I find very interesting here is, so Democrats, and this would include Amy Klobuchar, and let me speak now with a point of envy for our friend Harry Enten at CNN, who has put together a really nice ideological ranking of the senators who are
really?
Running.
I haven't seen that yet.
And Klobuchar is the most moderate. I had not figured, but she has the lowest score, and I found that, and Warren has the highest. But I found that interesting. But from Klobuchar and Harris, I support the Green New Deal as a starting point or a place to kick off the discussion or whatever. And the same thing. Yeah, I support Medicare for all. Like, let's just move past this. It is politically bad.
So bad.
disadvantageous. But also, I would say, in terms of running for president, yeah, I've signed on to this broad concept that I will commit myself to in the future, but we're going to make it better and change it as we go, and don't worry about that stuff. You are ceding control. This would be like if I know what it would be like. When Trump said, I'll let the Federalist Society pick my Supreme Court nominees. Now, if you like the Federalist Society and you like conservative Supreme Court nominees, that's great. If you don't, what the candidate is saying is, I am surrendering agency on this subject, and I will not be free to function here. And I think that's not a good idea. I think that what we always need in chief executives is flexibility, and we need them to be able to respond to the moments and not be the captives of particular things.
Right. Well, the high-speed rail was kind of a big answer to the Green New Deal, right? It was supposed to be one of the important ingredients.
But
even California can't pull it off.
So we have a problem. And the problem is, when you and I were growing up, the dominant – so there's Marxism and there's Marxism. There's the Marxism that acknowledges you can be a Marxist economist without being a Marxist, if that makes any sense. You can talk about the way that capital flows, and you can talk about the animating factors of economies, and you can have a worldview that lines up with that, but not say we need the government to impose things to change the way things work, right? It can be observational less than prescriptive. But the central theme of liberalism in America was arranged around income inequality, and it was arranged around a Marxist school of thought, an economic school of thought that said we need more socialism to ameliorate economic problems because economic problems are the big problem. What has happened in the past 15 years is that social justice – or a concept, the concept of intersectionality has surpassed that. And what the Green New Deal tries to do is bring everything together into one harmonious package to say we will address economic matters, we will address climate matters, but we will also address racism, we will also address sexism, we will address all of these things in one space unified under the umbrella of climate change. And I'll tell you what, that's a lot. That is a spicy meatball. And to try to do it all at once, Americans don't go for that. Americans are incrementalists. And Americans do want to protect the economy. And Americans do want to make all kind of things better. But what they don't want to do is have giant, grandiose schemes that commit us for eternity to something else.
Yep. Do you think that this is helping President Trump? He's got a little bump from the State of the Union. The economy has seemed to weather the shutdown okay. And then the Democrats do this.
You know what he got his bump from.
What?
Shutdown ended. That's good.
Yep.
And next is good is that the Democrats have spent the past 2 weeks in an absolute own goal. It has been an astonishing bad run for Democrats.
Oh, like Virginia?
What is happening? That Justin Fairfax is still in office, that he is still in office is, I would say it's hilarious if the stakes were not so high and the topics were not so serious. As we talked about before, whatever you think about the Me Too movement or whether you think it exceeded it, I don't want any whataboutism here. The first precept that I understand and one that I think we would all do well to absorb is that when a credible human, I'm not talking about the quality of the accusation, but when a credible human being comes forward and says, I was the victim of a crime at the hands of this person, right? What Justin Fairfax is accused of is not like his other fellow statewide elected members of insensitivity or, you know, bigotry in his heart. He's accused of two crimes by two credible people. These are not Lulus. And he is credibly accused. And he came out and he said, well, she was very interested. So he said that she's a woman of low character. And then he says, and either she's crazy or she's lying. Now, my understanding of this movement and my understanding of this precept is that that's the one thing you cannot do. You cannot smear your accuser. And he did that. And yet, he's still there. National Democrats know. Look, Ralph Northam, is already the ash heap of history awaiteth Ralph Northam. And I guess he could stay in office and continue to do a tour talking about racial sensitivity and being pitiful and trying not to moonwalk. He can do that if he wants. And Herring, the attorney general, I assume is just hiding under his desk like George Costanza. But the idea that Justin Fairfax is somehow still there and that Democrats are going to look the other way on this, they know that for Republicans, every time any top, it's like, oh, what about you mean Justin Fairfax? And much as with Omar, the congresswoman from Minnesota, the Democrats had a real good time kicking Republicans in the shins over Steve King.
Yeah.
And now it's like, okay, our turn. We get to kick you for a while. And it's so it's been a two very tough weeks for Democrats. And the president's numbers are back up to sort of the middle high range.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like Nancy Pelosi was advantaged under the shutdown as the leader of the Democratic Party nationally. She was advantaged during the shutdown. Trump got the blame and she could keep everybody in line. And when it was time for your Green New Deal or Green, what you said, nope. We got the shutdown on. Be quiet. Once, I assume, Trump signs this deal? I assume
Yeah,
so.
I think he's going to sign it.
Of course, this is exactly where we were in December when he pulled out and caused all of that catastrophe. But assuming that he signs it, that Pelosi is without the tool to keep her conference in line, and she is without this tool to focus the attention on Trump. The way that Trump gets back up, the way that Trump does better, is by people not talking about Trump. That's mm-hmm. how it's better.
Mm-hmm.
It's not about the State of the Union. It's not about whatever. It's about the focus is off Trump. Much as we observed in the 2016 election, in this era of negative partisanship, you win by having the story not be about you. Every day that the story is not about you,
True.
You do better.
How do you think that the Democratic candidates that announced over the weekend did? We have Elizabeth Warren, who had just announced her new campaign manager.
Who's her campaign manager?
I'll get it for you. He did her Senate races as well. Roger Lau.
Okay.
Roger
sure.
Lau. And then you had Amy Klobuchar in the snow. That was a great picture.
It was a great picture.
Amazing. And then she's out on the trail. So, and now you have others still out there, like Michael Bennett, the senator from Colorado, still saying that he's thinking about putting his hat in the ring.
Bennett's an interesting one. Thank you for mailbagging. I just saw that you mailbagged.
Yeah,
I was feeling guilty about not mailbagging. Bennett's an interesting case. Let me just speak in the meta. And in the meta, it is this. And Bennett is a triggering action here. He says, well, there's, you know, it's a big discussion. There's a lot of people in it. It can't hurt to have one more in it. Except for this, that as each one is killed, as each one of these, you know, let 10,000 flowers bloom. Except for in this case, when the flowers die, they may take others with them. And what do they do to survive? So you say, well, I'm getting in because everybody's getting in and then it's going to be interesting. Then once you get in, you say, well, if I'm not willing to really fight to try to win, why am I even here? And the rationalization scale ramps up very quickly. And then you end up where Chris Christie is killing Marco Rubio on stage in New Hampshire. And it happens pretty fast. And what you see, what you could see. So I would say right now of everybody running, Harris would be the best matchup for Trump among the Democratic field. Now, of course, she'd have to take a really white, really Midwestern, really traditional kind of Sherrod Brownie kind of person. But as her running mate, but she, I think, has the most natural energy. She has the most authentic kind of vibe. She seems to be able to talk to human beings, unlike some others, and sort of roll with the punches. she seems like the best bet for them about who for among those who are in there now. So let's say you're Bennett and you say, well, I'm going to get in. And you're like, and then your campaign manager says, well, I mean, aren't you really going to take her on about the times that she was not cool about sentencing and that she sent people to prison? And what about the African-American incarceration rate? And it's like, yeah, I should bring that up because if I'm running, I mean, I might as well run. This is not like the Democrats had in 2008, where you have a duel that rolls down over a series of weeks and months between two candidates. Punching back and forth. This is like what the Republicans had in 2016, which is it's a pig pile. And in the pig pile, you're going to kill helpful piglets, useful piglets along the way for the sake of servicing the campaigns of people who probably aren't good contenders to take on Donald Trump. And the fact that there is no I see little restraint among Democrats and very little consideration of this fact. And I think it all stems from they are vastly, vastly overestimating how easily they can beat Donald Trump.
Yep. I wanted to ask you what you thought about the recruitment so far by Democrats to try to get some of these Senate races to be competitive for 2020. For example, Mark Kelly down
Very
in
good
Arizona.
Recruit.
That's a good recruit, right, for Arizona?
Perfect recruit. Yep. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Martha McSally's got big trouble.
Mm. And what about Amy McGrath taking on John Cornyn, possibly, in Texas?
Well,
tough. That's a tough one.
I would put that in the same category as
Beto.
No, wait. It's McGrath is in Kentucky.
Oh, excuse me.
Hager.
Yep.
Yeah, Hager's in
MJ
Texas.
MJ Hager, yeah.
Right. But it's the same, you know, female veteran and coming hard at the entrenched power. Look, if John Cornyn's race is competitive, Donald Trump is going to lose 40 states. The only way that that's going to happen is it because Cornyn will outrun Trump in Texas. He will do better than Trump in Texas. And the only scenario under which Texas is really going to be in play in a quadrennial election year is if Trump is really going to lose Texas. And if Trump is going to lose Texas, he's going to lose everywhere. So I guess it's fine to have a candidate. And if you can make the Republicans spend some money out there, I guess it's good. But I mean, come on. The other one, but the one who will get all the attention, will be McGrath in Kentucky. And, we just lived through this 6 years ago, Allison Lundergan Grimes, and she's going to beat Mitch McConnell and
yeah.
She's great. And she's all of these things. It's amazing. All of the amazement and all of the profile pieces that will be written and all of the articles that talk about how great her ad was and all the grassroots money that she will raise. But there's only one way. There's a scenario of Mitch McConnell losing counts on two preconditions. One, he has to endure a bad primary, which is possible. There, you never know. You certainly never know. But one would think that given his the yeoman work that he has done in the opening years of the Trump president, in the first term of the Trump presidency, one would think he would be safer now than he was before when I can't remember who there was a medium. Oh, he's the governor now, Matt Bevin. I was going to say medium chucklehead. Sorry. But he drew a primary challenge, fended it off, then had all of this money for Grimes that came in and was like, oh, it's going to be close. It's going to be close. It's going to be close. Oh, psych. He's going to win by 10 points.
Yep.
The only way that McConnell is going to lose, he could lose in a primary, but he could be weakened in a primary. And then again, Trump would have to be competitive. He would have to be losing in Kentucky or have to be tied in Kentucky. McConnell might underperform Trump in Kentucky. So it would have to be tied or pretty close. I understand why Chuck Schumer wants that. If Mitch McConnell thought that he could get a credible sounding candidate to run against Chuck Schumer in New York, he would do it.
Yeah.
Just to put a little extra, a little sand in the gears. But give me a break.
Give me a break. I did. Before we go to questions, I have to ask you about Senator Cory Booker and his veganism and how the planet cannot sustain people eating meat.
Well,
I mean, another own goal.
Well, I will say Once upon a time, the absolute convinced truth, the unambiguous truth, was that we were facing a global starvation crisis, that India would not be able to feed itself, mm-hmm. and that China would not be able to feed itself, and that we were in fact doomed, and that it was imminent. And this is as recently as the 1980s, that the population bomb was going to go off and we were done. And then we weren't, because science answered the question with new fertilizers, new farming methods, new things that could produce more food. The belief now is that as the world grows wealthier, they want to eat like Americans eat, which is red meat, which is more protein, which is away from staple grains and towards more animal protein, and that that's unsustainable given what's going on. Maybe. I don't know. I don't pretend to know. I think the idea, though, that the president, the person who's running for the president of the United States, having an opinion about whether or not I have to eat crickets in the future. Have you ever had the cashew cheese?
No.
I mean, I'm here to tell you, it's wrong. It feels wrong. It smells wrong.
Well, this is an interesting debate that's going on that the dairy farmers are having with the nut producers for milk.
Right.
I think this debate's so interesting.
Which part? The nut juice part?
Like, is it almond milk? Is that really milk?
You can't milk an almond.
It's nut juice.
It's nut juice.
And that now the cattlemen are having it with the impossible meat or whatever that is.
Yeah.
The veggie burgers. But they're saying it's meat.
Right.
But it's not meat. And they don't have the same regulations and everything. It's a really interesting debate. I need to dig into it a little bit more. Of course, my instinct is to side with the cattlemen. Always. And forever be true. But
they're doing some very interesting things.
Have you had one of these impossible burgers?
No.
Have you had one?
No.
I would like to do a taste test.
I'm feeling like passing. They're doing, I think the possibility of factory meat is much closer than people think, in which the T cells from beef and animals can be used to produce meat in a factory as opposed to having to farm. I think that that's probably close-ish. I think there are probably some upsides to that, and I think people will get used to it in a lot sooner and more easily than they would the idea of eating crickets or of eating something else. And it'll be a labeling. The reason these labeling fights are so significant is because if factory-made meat that is essentially the cell replication. But if it tastes like beef and it cooks like beef and it looks like beef, then people won't particularly care. And for the cattlemen, they know that if they lose control of that word of what's beef, then they got a problem. And I think that's all out there. I think there are interesting things that are on the horizon. And I think that we're more able to solve problems than we give ourselves credit for. And very often, I will quote Calvin Coolidge, never go out to meet a problem. 90% of them will get in the ditch before they get to you. And it's great to be thinking about the future. It's great to be thinking about all this other stuff. But I still trust and believe in the capacity of human beings to solve the problems that confront us.
Yeah, I also believe in voters wanting to eat meat.
Yes, of course voters want to eat meat, because we're not going to eat vegan cheese.
No.
And when, you know, Barack Obama had a tendency to, he would say, well, the world's not, he said once when he was campaigning, the world's not going to just tolerate us keeping our thermostat set at 72 and blah, 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 blah. And it was like, well, we don't care particularly what the world thinks. And for Booker, look, people don't listen to Donald Trump. They don't fact check him. People still fact check him. They don't fact check him anymore because it's like, well, Donald Trump said this, and then they say, well, Donald Trump says a lot of things.
Yeah.
If you're taking his word as gospel or using him as a factual basis for making analysis, you're doing it wrong. But Booker's not going to be held to that standard. He'll be held to a higher standard. They'll all be held to a higher standard than Trump, which is one of Trump's big advantages. Managed expectations are one of his big advantages. But if Booker's out there and others and want to pass judgment on things and have professorial opinions about things and say, well, I feel that in the future the earth needs to eat crickets and soy cheese and this is what we all will have to do to come together. It's like, bro, you don't need to have opinions about everything. It's not necessary.
So I'm going to go to questions then. Laughing Monkey asks if you are familiar with the Copenhagen Consensus Center. It's a think tank. It's the one that Bjørn Lomborg is a part of.
Oh, I know his work.
Yeah,
I didn't
his
know
work's
that
amazing.
I want to tell
one
you
time
what
he got kicked out. Well, I don't know. He didn't get kicked out. I think Jim Conanton at the White House invited him to have breakfast in the White House mess. And mm-hmm. Bjorn arrived, but he didn't have a tie, I think. And it was like a big – I just remember it was like a big
Well, I think I want to tell you what a hillbilly I am. What's it called?
Copenhagen Consensus Center.
When you said Copenhagen Consensus, I thought that it had to do with
chewing
dip.
Tobacco.
Yep, I thought it had to do with dip, and I was like, I'm willing to find out about the Copenhagen Consensus. I like it, but obviously it's about climate. But I think doing this applies to the environment, and this applies to almost everything in public life, or most of the things in public life, which are do the things that you can. Just because we can't, just because there's not going to be a consensus around the Green New Deal doesn't mean that we shouldn't do things that are readily, easily available to us that everybody agrees that we ought to do. And consensus is cool.
Christina Clifton asks, is 2020 setting up to be another 1972? With Nixon on the ropes, the Dems come up with George McGovern.
I don't know. It'll depend on what the Dems do. I think it's way too soon to say that. I think it's way, way too soon to say that. And we also, unlike 1972, there was an issue when you got down to it in 1972. And that issue was Vietnam. That's not the case this time.
Yep. Okay. Jenny T. Miller asks this. Like you, I have two man children who are how are you preparing them for a culture that despises them? She's referring to the Esquire magazine article and subsequent backlash. Thanks, and hail West Virginia.
Hail West Virginia. I'm not preparing them for a culture that despises them. I am not preparing them to be despised. I won't. I am preparing them to love their neighbor as themselves. And do I have fears about what's to come? Of course I do. But I will not make victims out of these people. And I see so much victimology coming in.
You know, it's not just for men. Like yesterday at this Palm Springs event, mm-hmm. I got a chance to meet with the high school students that come from all over the valley. I think each school gets to send 15 of them. And then I did Q&A for about a half an hour. And the first question I got was from a young woman who said, how have you been able to manage in a male-dominated field with male employees standing in your way? Blah, blah. And I was like, ladies and gentlemen, it used to be like that. I said, but there are now more women in journalism and communications than there are men.
Oh,
and they're doing better in every measure of graduation rates and first jobs and home ownership and like stop it. I think it's good to be aware of these things that are happening, but them thinking that they're the young women in the room are already thinking that they're not going to be able to succeed because some man is going to stand in their way, and then the men in the room are like, wait, could anybody focus on us for a minute here?
Well, I would just say, I am raising sons. Their mother and I are raising sons who are leaders, who are thoughtful, who are strong, who are Christian, who are all those things. And I so despair at the degree to which for white Americans, that white Americans, and I don't think most are, but a large number are embracing this victimhood. I despise it. There will be a new generation of leaders who will arise. race will not mean the same things 25 years from now that they do.
Yeah.
Think about how different our conversations about race are now than they were 25 years ago.
Yeah, let's ask Governor Northam.
Right, exactly. And the discussion will be very different 25 years hence. I will not prepare my children for some dystopia in which they will be victimized because of their ethnicity, because of their faith, because of their gender. I will not do it. What I will do is what I would do under any circumstance with a boy or a girl, with anyone, which is raise them to be the best you know, as we always say, God made you to be somebody. Now go be it.
Yeah.
And as to quote my dad, as Bees said, if it's okay with you and it's okay with God, then it's probably okay. So go do it. And that's what it's about. And it's not about living in a defensive crouch because you're afraid that somebody's going to take something away from you that you have. What it's about is leaning into the world with a smile on your – well, with a shoe shine and a smile and going out after it.
Very well said. Hey, by the way, this just in.
Yep.
House Republican leaders won't commit to backing a border deal that would prevent a new shutdown.
I'm sure they won't.
Here we go again.
Donald Trump must say first.
Although I guess he'll sign it and then do a national emergency. That's what I think they were going to do all along.
Well, remember the secret. The wall was inside of us all along. The wall was always within our hearts.
We only had to believe.
We only had to believe.
Okay, trivia for you.
Yes.
Question number one, from the time it was admitted to the Union in 1858 until the Great Depression, Minnesota voted for Republican candidates in every presidential election except one. Things have obviously changed a bit. If you can give me the year and the candidate.
I think. Was it definitely one of the two major parties?
Mm-hmm.
Bonewald is yes. That's a yes. Okay. So it was one of the two major parties-ish. He's waving me off. It's no help having him down here. He's down here and I get no help out of it. So the question is, from statehood in 1858 to 1932,
mm-hmm.
It was Republican except for 1 year. And that was the year that it voted for William Jennings Bryan, I guess. No?
No, wait. Bonewald waved you off of that?
What? Was it one of the two major? I'm just asking for a hint. It was not one of the two. So it had to be the Populist Party, and it had to be, and it had to be La Follette.
Obviously.
Okay. Well, that was a weird head shake. That's like you would be a terrible major league pitcher.
I'm telling you. I'm looking in here. And he's like
the worst.
Sometimes he's like nodding.
Yeah,
yes,
and it's like a sideways
but he's
nod.
Saying no.
Like a handshake. It's like whatever. You're the worst emoji. You're the worst emoji. I'll just say for the record. Okay, I'm not even looking at
Bonewald
anymore.
Let's see if he can redeem himself in question number two.
Well, what year did the Populist Party win?
1912.
In Minnesota? And that was
Roosevelt.
Robert La Follette.
Theodore Roosevelt.
Oh. Duh. Okay, so go ahead.
Question number two. Since 1900, California has grown from a state with 9 electoral votes to its current 55. The largest mm-hmm. growth of any state during that time period. Which mm-hmm. state has lost the most electoral votes in that same time period? Very interesting question.
I feel like it has to be New York, just simply because New York had so many. But I'm tempted to say Pennsylvania because
Pennsylvania
had so many.
Yep, okay. It's Pennsylvania. It was in 1900. It had 32. It later grew to a high of 38, and now it is only 20.
It is not by accident that General Meade's statue stands on Pennsylvania Avenue, which is the street that connects the Capitol to the White House.
Not at all.
Not at all.
All right. Question number three. Since voting for Calvin Coolidge in the 1924 presidential election, Massachusetts voters have cast their votes for just two Republican candidates since then. Can you name them?
Reagan and Nixon.
Eisenhower and Reagan.
Oh, Nixon didn't get – oh, obviously not. Okay.
Oh, Jason Bonewald. Are you going to chase him around the studio in there?
It was a scattershot outing on my part today, and I apologize to everyone for my failings. But Jason screwed me up with his weird head nods.
So you're going to Savannah, Georgia this weekend?
This weekend. On Friday or Saturday. If you want to feel the Everyman a King energy, if you want to be part of our discussion, you should come to the Savannah Theater.
Yes.
Yes.
People are going to love it.
and I'm going to do a book sign. I'll do book signings after the evening one and after the morning one.
Wow. You're going to have a great time. They're so lucky to have you.
I love Savannah.
It's a great place.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks, everybody. Red Eye. All right. For more podcasts, go to foxnewspodcast.com. Don't forget to subscribe to this one on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen. And please leave us a review. We're a little behind. You know who.
You know who.
All right. This has been Perino and Starwalt. I'll tell you what. Fox News Radio.